We've talked about marriage and family, and now we're going to focus in this segment on children. And we've already said some things about children. We'll recap some of that and do more. There's an interesting little sculpture here. It's part of a funerary monument that depicts a number of children doing children's kinds of things, you know, fighting each other and playing games with each other. Very normal kind of thing. And this was on the sarcophagus of a child who died. So children are investments for the future. And they are, I think, for anybody, particularly in this kind of culture in which, as we said, death is everywhere, and the survival of your children cannot at all be taken for granted. And we have a close-up here on this screenshot of one of those groups of people from that very tall funerary monument that I said you're going to be seeing more of. And we know from the inscription below that both the man and the woman here are freed people, a freedman and freedwoman of someone named Lucius Firmius. And we'll talk about slaves and freed in the next segment. And his original name is Principis, and hers is Apollonia. So now they are freed persons, and they have they keep their own personal names, but then they use the name Firmius is the name of their former master owner, and they have a little daughter whose name is Lesbia, and she also died. Little child in the mother's hand. I hope you can see that, this little face that's just popping up there. So this is an image of a nuclear family, and the parents seem to be of a certain age. They don't seem to be really that young, but they had this little daughter. So that's the depiction. So I've got three Latin words down there, and we've talked about potestas already. That's the power of the male head of the household over everybody else. I alluded to the reality of tutela, but I didn't actually explain what it was before. Tutela is the custom of putting an adult woman, and children as well, under the authority of a male agent. So particularly for administration of property, for buying and selling of property. And in Roman law, that was a custom, and it was a custom in Egyptian law as well, and many of these legal systems, that women were not actually legal adults. They were considered legal minors who were not capable of making their own decisions. And this is part of this whole family structure, you see, where all kinds of decisions, particularly about property and about people, children, and marriage, are expected to be made not alone, but within the context, the broader context of their family, the good of their family. But of course, there's a double standard here, because the male, who has potestas, can go ahead and do whatever he wants on his own decision. Everybody else has to be under his authority for it. Now, I said earlier, quite a bit earlier, I think, that this whole idea of adult women being under male authority in questions of property was, by the New Testament period, was not taken terribly seriously. And the way we know this is, again, part of Augustus's marriage legislation. He wanted to encourage Roman citizen women to have more children. And so he said, if a freeborn Roman citizen woman would have three children who survived to the age of one. Now that tells you something too about child mortality, who survived to the age of one, she could be freed from tutela. So she didn't have to have the approval of her male guardian to buy or sell property. She could do it on her own. See, that tells you that it wasn't taken terribly seriously by that time. The other image, or rather the other term here, is municipio, and that has to do with emancipation. Now, in some systems that practice slavery, among them in the United States, the word emancipation means the freeing of slaves. That is not what it means here. Their word for freeing of slaves was manumissio, manumission, and we'll talk about that later. Emancipation is the freedom of other subordinate members of the family from the power of potestas of the father figure. So when the father died, everybody in the family was emancipated. They acquired their own legal autonomy. The men did, and the women increasingly more so did. And when boys attained the age of about 18 to 20, there was a kind of a relative stage of emancipation that they also had. So that's about not the freeing of slaves, but the freeing of subordinates, legal subordinates, free people, from the power of the male head of the household. Now, it's also been estimated, you know, with average life expectancies, that for the most part, because people just didn't live that long, for the most part, when children became adults, when they got into the let's say the 20s, it's likely the father was already dead. So in many cases, they perhaps did not have to wait until the father died because he had already died. So that's all part of that structure. Some collections of children's toys. You see little wagons, dolls, animals. At one point, there's a bird up there with on wheels that could be pulled. These are a part of a collection that used to be in the Archaeological Museum at Ephesus. I took these pictures years ago, and the last times that I've been there, they have not been on display anymore. But I think they are really—it's really helpful to see how they did produce toys that children could play with. So something about education and socialization of children. I had already talked about, when we were talking about literacy, the levels of education, boys who from families who could afford it, going to school and learning how to read and write, to be prepared to take their role in the world in whatever system their family was in. And I should say this, very few people probably ever left the situation in which their family was, except in the case of trauma, of disturbance, war, the breakup of everything, you know. But in ordinary life, people simply lived in the same circles for generations. And children inherited their father's, their family's property, their father's business, whatever it was, and simply continued in the same way. There was very little rupture, other than, as I said, with war, famine, whatever the catastrophic things. There was very little social change. Somebody just deciding to go off and start a business in another city or something like that. Very little of that, as far as we know. There certainly was a lot of, as I've said, massive immigration into Rome. That's looking for work, and that would be mostly unskilled labor. So a lot of movement, a lot of social movement, but not a lot of sort of starting over as an adventure, you know, only when necessary. Now, men, boys, were for the most part socialized to be leaders in whatever way they could, particularly in the upper classes, to be leaders and to protect and continue the family and continue the honor of the family. And women, girls, were socialized to not to be leaders, but to prepare for marriage, to know how to run a household, do whatever household things needed to be done. And households were centers of production as well as consumption. And that's perhaps an important thing to say as well, that and that's still true in many cultures, that the household produces whatever it can of things that it needs. And you might remember in the book of Proverbs, the last chapter, chapter 31, there's this wonderful meditation on the woman householder who prepares for everything, and she sees to it that they do their weaving and they do their gardening and their it's an interesting description of the kinds of things that go on in a fairly wealthy household and the things that are actually manufactured within the household itself. So girls are taught all of this in appropriate to their social level, either to do these things or to learn how to teach somebody else to do it. But for all of the kinds of skills that that a girl is expected to do in a household. And I want to say something here about the question of honor and shame. There's been a lot studied on this, and it comes out of anthropology, the anthropological study of Mediterranean cultures, as honor-shame cultures. And what that means is that the predominant social values are not success or achievement or efficiency or wealth, but rather honor. That maintaining family honor, the reputation, the public reputation of the family. Don't shame the family. Don't do something that is going to bring shame on the family. But rather to everybody must preserve the public reputation for honor of the family. And if something does happen, if a member of the family does something that violates public acceptability, it brings shame on the family. And the whole family is affected, and it can be affected for more than one generation. How do males preserve honor by being valiant and honorable and honest and esteemed for their character, and at the same time, of course, being successful in what they do? How do women preserve that honor? By their sexual integrity. Because the in this way of thinking, the bodies of women really convey the honor of the family. And so obviously adultery is a violation. Anything outside the norms of sexual propriety, virginity until marriage, fidelity within marriage, celibacy and widowhood. And preserving the honorable reputation of the family, not doing anything that would even make people question the honor of the family. So that's a way of approaching this, of looking at the differences in the way males and females were socialized. So, it's interesting to point out that there's no evidence, when we look at Christian raising of children, there's no evidence until the 4th century of anything like a Christian curriculum. There may have been. We don't have the evidence for it. And in the 4th century, we do begin to get a few people talking about how do you raise a child, particularly Jerome writing to his friend Paula, and you'll get to know them a little later, about how to raise her daughters. And that, of course, is within the context of an ascetic lifestyle. So, and that there, he has them raised on the scriptures. They learned literacy early so that they can read the scriptures, and he gives them advice about which books to start on, you know, and the Psalms especially. The Psalms are the favorites. They are to memorize the Psalms and to pray them regularly. The Song of Songs, he says, sort of leave that until they're older. You know, that's too much for the children to handle. But the Gospels, of course. And so you begin to get a sense of what a Christian education was actually like. And so it's a kind of a gradual evolution, I think, from Homer and Virgil to Scripture. The whole educational system before that is based on Homer for Greek and Virgil for Latin. And the evidence that we have for the education of boys in Rome is bilingual. They are learning both Latin and Greek at the same time, and they're keeping them straight. And the literary models in both cases are Homer and Virgil, the classics, so that everyone is familiar with those classic texts. And at the beginning, Christians must have done the same thing. Because that was the way you learned. That's what you learned when you went to school. And it really took a couple of centuries, though I think they must have started teaching the scriptures to their children earlier than the 4th century, certainly. But we just don't have any discussion of a system of how to do that. What you learned when you went to school was Homer and Virgil. Eventually, there would be develop a Christian sense of, but we have our own text, we have our own literature, and this is what they should be learning. And by that time, of course, you've got a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible from a couple of centuries before that. It's not necessarily the best literary style, but it was something that was in the language that they knew, and from which they could learn from a Christian perspective. So that's what we think was going on in the educational system for children.